Case number 06-1364, et al. Network IP, LLC, and Network Enhanced Telecom, LLP, petitioners versus Federal Communications Commission, et al. Mr. Pryor for the petitioners, Mr. Joshi for the respondents.
May it please the court, I will be referring to the petitioners as NET or NET during this argument. We're here because the FCC did not fairly conduct these proceedings. Its job was to have taken the facts in the record and fairly apply them to the rules as they existed at the time. That's not what happened. Instead, they ignored crucial facts in the record, made up new law out of whole cloth, and when it came time for damages, brushed aside their own precedent and the statute of limitations in order to maximize recovery. And these decisions, if upheld, will have a devastating impact on the small entrepreneurial company and its employees. NET therefore is asking that this court take a hard look at this case, because it's not a case about deference. It's a case about fairness. Now, there's no dispute.
An awful lot of administrative law is about deference and not fairness.
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't sit to do general equity.
No, that's not. My point was a little different, Your Honor. My point was about deference. Is this is not really a case about whether or not the FCC reasonably interpreted its rules to allow or to interpret its rules as including this possessory interest requirement. Now, they are normally given, yes, substantial deference in interpreting their own rules. But even if you assume that what went on here was an interpretation of its rules, and you permit deference to allow this, to assume that it's reasonable for possessory interest, that's only the first step in the analysis. The next step, and the more important step, is whether or not it was then fair to impose that new interpretation.
Why was it so new? You read paragraphs 92 and 86 together. It certainly seems to require a possessory interest, or at least to contemplate the possibility of a possessory interest. It doesn't seem like this came out of nowhere.
Right. Well, the way the payphone orders...
And I understand if you read 92 in isolation, but if you read 92 with 86, it's certainly within the realm of possibility that this was going to be the final answer.
Sure. Well, let me address that. In paragraph 86, the first payphone order, the FCC said, yes, we want to put liability on the carrier that's the primary economic beneficiary, but for administrative convenience, we'll limit responsibility to the facilities-based carrier. But did not define facilities-based there. In the reconsideration motion in paragraph 52, reconsideration order, the FCC there said, well, let me clarify what we mean by a facilities-based carrier. What we mean is a carrier that maintains its own switching capability, regardless if the switching equipment is owned or leased. Now, when it came to this set of orders...
And one plausible way to read that is to say that your facilities-based, regardless whether it's owned or leased.
It may be a plausible way to read that, and again, given deference to the FCC, it may, in fact,
without deference, it's an entirely rational way to read the language, isn't it?
Well, let me go take that a little bit further. When it came time for the FCC to figure out what a facilities-based carrier was in this particular case, they didn't start with their own definition of maintaining switching capability that they had adopted specifically in the payphone context. Instead, they turned to a wide variety of authorities that they claim always, where they claim facilities-based always denotes having possessory interest. But now they concede at page 27 of their brief that, in fact, some of those authorities have been interpreted to not require possessory interest. In fact, the first two statutory authorities that they identify, section 271 and section 214E, both have been interpreted by the FCC specifically not to require possessory interest in order to be facilities-based. So where the FCC now is coming, this is the notice issue, where the FCC now has to be is it says, the authorities we said provided you notice of a possessory interest actually didn't require a possessory interest at all. So they're supposed to have read...
Some of the prior existing use did not require possessory interest. That was in different context completely than what we have here, wasn't it?
Well, two things about that. One, it's we didn't pick those cases to stand for the proposition of what's facilities-based here. In this case, they did. They cited those authorities, not us. And secondly, the context...
They also cited authorities that did have... that had used the possessory interest requirement, didn't they?
Well, they cited authorities that uses words like a leasehold...
The Bureau of Liability order, didn't it refer to the... it was one of the authorities cited, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, which one, Your Honor?
Bureau of Liability order, that was...
Well, that's its own order. I mean, that's the case here where it came up with this possessory interest test. That was not...
But doesn't the plain meaning of the term suggest...
Yeah,
A possessory interest.
No, and I mean, here's why.
And sometimes the FCC has not limited itself to that, but certainly you being cognizant of what's going on in this area, hear that term, and you would think that's a possibility at least.
Well,
going back to your notice point.
Sure. Well, here's why it's not such a great a possibility as you might think. The key here really is the question of how in the telecom industry does one obtain switching capabilities through the lease of equipment? Obviously, ownership is not an issue here. The issue here was, did NETS telecommunications customers lease equipment? Now, the FCC says a lease has to be like an equipment lease, has to include the serial number of the switch and so forth. But this context of unbundled network elements that you mentioned, Your Honor, one of the key unbundled network elements is something called switching capability. And one lease...
Getting pretty far from what the question was. What does facilities-based mean if it doesn't mean what the FCC says it does here?
It means you can lease equipment by having a right to use without having to have a possessory interest.
So you would say the definition of facilities-based is broader than the one the FCC uses?
Yes, absolutely. And this unique context explains why. Because as the FCC in the Bureau of Liability Order notes, this unique context is analogous to this context. Unis are, quote, the switching capability unbundled network element is leased. But the FCC now admits, of course, that you lease that switching equipment, that switching capability, without having to take a possessory interest in the equipment itself. You simply lease capacity by obtaining a right to use. And that is what NET provided.
What would not be a facilities-based carrier then? What would fall?
A pure reseller, Your Honor. Someone who simply takes someone else's services and resells them.
So the only thing it excludes is the reseller who does not do anything else but resell.
Well, yes, because it at least doesn't include what NET's customers were doing. That is, NET's customers were facilities-based in the sense that they had a right to use switching capabilities through contracts with NET. It's the same as having a contract to obtain switching capabilities with a major telephone company to obtain an unbundled network element switching capability. That is a lease, and it does not involve a possessory interest. So it was perfectly reasonable for NET to believe that its customers were maintaining switching capability without having to actually take physical possession of NET switch.
Could Net have contracted around this problem?
I'm sorry?
Could Net have contracted around this problem with the debit card providers?
With 2020 hindsight, knowing that the FCC later was going to come up with this possessory interest, sure, they could have written their contract to look like a lease. Now, the actual practicality on the ground wouldn't have changed. You could use different words, but this is really not about words. This is about what business was Net in. And it was in the business of letting other carriers use their switching equipment, control the switching capabilities housed in that equipment, in order to provide their own telecommunications services.
You think the debit card providers would have been on fair notice if the FCC had come out the other way here?
I don't know whether they would have or not, but I'll call them the telecommunications.
Doesn't that show the problem with the notice argument?
No, because the debit card, I'm going to call them telecommunications carriers, the debit card providers signed contracts with Net by which they assumed the responsibility to make payphone compensation payments. And it was perfectly reasonable for Net to believe that through that contract, they could, in fact, have assumed that liability and did assume that liability and would be the carriers that the FCC would hold liable because they maintained their own switching capability. But more than that, they met virtually every criteria that the FCC laid out in their orders. Net's customers were the primary economic beneficiaries of these calls because it was their customers, their end users, who were using the payphones. Net's customers had the ability to track payphone calls. That is, they could tell if a call was coming from a payphone and whether it was answered. And that's the only switching capability that the FCC ever gave any significance to in its payphone orders. And then, as I said, they agreed explicitly in contracts to assume liability. And under the Commission's Bell Atlantic order, a carrier that maintains its own switching capability and identifies itself as taking on the responsibility lifts the liability from a carrier like Net and places it squarely on customers on telecommunications carriers like Net's customers. And then to make this structure work, one of the switching capabilities that Net turned over to its telecom carrier customers was the ability to go into Net's switch and instruct the switch to set payphone surcharges that they would charge their own end users in order to collect the money they needed to pay the payphone owners. Now, Net never collected any money for payphone compensation because it had structured its business around a reasonable idea that its customers were the ones that were liable. And as this court has said in satellite broadcasting, the FCC cannot punish a member of the regulated class, cannot punish Net for reasonably interpreting the Commission's regulations. And I think for all of these reasons that I just went through, it was reasonable for Net to have interpreted
the payphone. Unless my colleagues have more questions on this issue, I would like for you to get to the statute of limitations and waiver issue.
Yes, certainly. Let me move right to that then, please. The statute of limitations here is, everyone agrees, is the one set forth in the Communications Act, Section 415. The courts and the FCC have strictly construed that provision. It is to be applied even when it causes hardship. Here, the FCC refused to apply it because it would cause hardship. Now, the FCC has no power to waive or override the congressionally enacted statute of limitations. Now, it claims that it's not overriding or waiving the statute of limitations. It's simply waiving one of its own rules. Now, it does have rules that, under limited circumstances, permit the tolling of the statute of limitations. But let's be clear, those circumstances were not met here. In order to take advantage of tolling under the FCC's rules, APCC had to file its formal complaint on a date certain. There's no dispute that that date was missed. In fact, they didn't get around to filing the complaint until 2.5 weeks later. The FCC.
Well, that's because of the $5 issue, right?
It's because they missed. They didn't understand what the filing fee was. That's right.
$5 short, so it ended up being.
Well, they were kind of. It turns out lucky it was only $5 short because they actually had no clue what the filing fee was because they hadn't checked the rules. But the FCC. In order to take, advantage, I was saying, of this tolling rule, APCC had to file on time, and it didn't. And the FCC found no valid reason for missing the date. In fact, it called it inexcusable, easily avoidable, negligent. Now, the FCC's own precedent would foreclose waiving the deadline under these circumstances. Under the rule set out in Meredith, the FCC may find good cause to waive a filing deadline in an adjudication only if there's been something like a widespread calamity, something well beyond control of counsel. And here there was absolutely nothing like that, and there's no dispute about it. And that rule in Meredith, unlike the FCC's argument now, that rule in Meredith has been applied by the FCC to all manner of adjudicatory filings, not simply those that start a case. The FCC's own precedent would have foreclosed it had it been applied in this case to waiving the deadline.
Of your argument, if you succeed in your argument,
yes.
Does this totally bar APCC's claim, or does it bar a portion of
it? It bars a portion, Your Honor. What they've done effectively under the circumstances of this case through this waiver is effectively tripled the damages period. For the damages at issue, it'll reduce it from about 15 months to about 5 months. But it does not eliminate the claim. It's just how far back do you go? So instead of applying their own strict rules, the FCC here applied its own general waiver standard. And the way it came out was, well, we don't want to let APCC's filing mistakes potentially deprive the payphone owners that APCC was representing. We don't want to deprive them potentially of these additional months and months of recovery. Now, a desire to maximize recovery cannot be a unique circumstance, even under the Commission's general waiver standard, because then you would virtually grant every waiver. But another problem has come up, and it came up after.
Well, I mean, it could have also been that the magnitude of the mistake here was not such that it fell outside a good cause in the Commission's judgment. There was an attempt to comply with the deadline. They were $5 short on the fee. That happens. And context, the magnitude of the mistake did not warrant the consequences, and they applied the good cause. I mean, that doesn't seem irrational.
Well, let me make 2 points about that. One is, I don't think you can find that APCC exercised due diligence in here in trying to preserve its claims. It slapped together a complaint at the last minute, didn't check what the filing rules were, and then...
If they'd filed it with $5 more, would it have met the timeliness requirement?
Well, they actually made one other mistake. They didn't put in the right number of checks. But yes, if they had done that, that would have met the timeliness. Yes. Now, the general waiver analysis that the FCC did, as I was saying, was we don't want to let that filing mistake hurt APCC's principals, these independent payphone owners. Now, bear in mind, APCC doesn't own payphones. It's simply a billing and collection agent. And it was there on behalf...
It used to say it didn't have any interest in these claims, and then several opinions and several dissents later, they suddenly say they do have an interest.
Exactly, Your Honor. I'm sure you're well aware of that, given your dissent in the standing case.
It would have saved us a lot of work if they'd stayed with the same story throughout. I don't know what it was they had in mind, but...
Right. Well, they got to the Supreme Court on a different story. But as I said, it turns out now, the policy rationale, again, is... We really don't want to make sure these payphone owners get paid because the statute says they should be compensated. Now it turns out that APCC isn't going to pass all the money through. They're going to keep some of it. Now, that fact didn't come to light until after the FCC's proceeding had long closed. But that fact thoroughly undermines the Commission's own public policy rationale for granting the waiver here. It's one thing to say we're not going to let APCC's mistake hurt payphone owners. They never asked, well, should we let APCC's mistake hurt APCC? So I want to, if I can, unless there are further questions, just briefly touch on the issue of prejudgment interest.
Very quickly.
The FCC here imposed a rate of prejudgment interest that it itself had found to be unfair and punitive. The rate of interest, 11.25%, the FCC itself has found not only to be unfair and punitive with respect to late payments, but to have absolutely no relevance to the independent payphone owners that are involved in this kind of case. In the fourth and fifth payphone orders, the FCC was very clear. It said when it comes to late payments, the correct rate to apply is the IRS rate, not the 11.25% rate. The FCC here, in fact, gives no reasonable basis for using this 11.25% rate was the rate of return calculated for the biggest telephone companies 20 years ago. They provide no basis for applying that rate of interest to independent payphone owners. And the FCC itself recognized in the fifth payphone owner order that 11.25% has no relevance to independent payphones. So it was completely arbitrary and capricious for the Commission to apply that rate of interest in this case. And to sort of highlight the point, after we filed our opening brief, the FCC issued an order in this case, Contel, that we discussed in our reply. It was the same kind of case. A carrier was found liable for payphone compensation. The Commission determined the amount of damages and then it imposed a rate of interest at the IRS rate.
Okay. Your time is up, Captain.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good morning. I'm Nandan Joshi for the FCC. Let me start by saying we agree with you, Judge Santel. This case is about deference. The FCC gets a substantial deference in the interpretation of its rules and its orders. I think the standard is clearly erroneous. Not only that, it gets deference when it applies that rule in an adjudication involving claims for monies owed, and in fact has a responsibility to apply that its interpretation to the facts of this case. There is a presumption of retroactivity for adjudications that this court has announced, and in fact, in the Quest case, it reversed the FCC when the FCC, in this court's view, too easily granted a waiver of retroactivity. So the whole notion of fair notice simply does not apply in this case. This case is about whether the FCC reasonably interpreted its payphone compensation rule to conclude that NET's customers were not the type of carriers that were liable under the rules for payphone compensation. And the FCC, that determination was reasonable for two separate reasons. First, NET's customers are not facilities-based carriers. There's no dispute. It appears that there is a facilities-based requirement for a carrier to be responsible for payphone compensation. The dispute is whether a carrier such as NET's customers that do not have any facilities, any telecommunications facilities, simply have service agreements with NET, are facilities-based carrier. And the Commission reasonably concluded that they were not. The general use of the term facilities-based connotes some type of possessory interest, as the FCC has mentioned in its order, and the Bureau pointed out in its order on review. In the Bureau liability order. That's the footnote 35 of the Bureau liability order. NET's customers simply do not have those facilities. They are pure resellers with tracking capability. That's NET's argument. That's the only thing that distinguishes them from other types of resellers that would not be subject to the payphone compensation.
Isn't that a switching capability?
No, switching capability is switching. Tracking can be used in conjunction with switching capability, but it, by itself, the Commission has never defined it. Tracking by itself as switching capability. The UNI rules that they reference, for example, talk about switching plus tracking. They're trying to rely on just the tracking component to say, because our customers were able to track payphone calls, therefore we can shift liability to them. Now, they can certainly use contracts to make their customers pay this compensation, but if that compensation is not paid by the customers, NET is still on the hook. And the Commission found in the damages order that, in fact, there was no compensation for the calls that were routed through NetSwitch, and that finding is not challenged on review. The second component of the Commission's analysis, just briefly, is that even if something less than a possessory interest would be sufficient make a carrier, a facilities-based carrier. Once again, NET's customers did not maintain switching capability as the FCC interpreted its rules because they did not simply because they had call tracking capabilities. I would like to I'd like to turn to the statute of limitations question.
I'd like you to.
And there are 3 points I'd like to make. First, on the statutory, the argument that the commission has waived the statute of limitations period. That is not our position. The statute of limitations was met by the filing of the two informal complaints, which were concededly within the statutory.
Is there other authority that informal complaints stop the running of the statute?
I am not aware of any case law on that.
I'm not either. I'm wondering why it would. You have to file the formal complaint to begin the adjudicatory proceeding. If they had never filed this formal complaint, we wouldn't have the proceeding, would we?
As a result of the commission's rules, 415B refers.
Yeah, that's a yes or no question.
If they had not filed
if they had not filed the formal complaint, would we have this proceeding?
No, that's correct. But
so, what does the informal complaint have to do with the question then? The beginning of the adjudicatory proceeding seems to be the filing of the formal complaint.
That's not correct, Judge Chantel. First of all, let me first turn to the text of the statute. It refers to all complaints. All complaints against carriers for the recovery of damages must be filed within the statutory period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the commission, as truly as a result of it,
adjudicating is the one that's called the formal complaint, right?
The formal complaint is a necessary step in the process for adjudicating.
Is the informal complaint unnecessary?
It is not. That's a voluntary step. But under the commission's,
It really is not. I really don't see what the connection is between that informal complaint and the statute of limitations question.
Your Honor, that argument is not a challenge to the waiver of the rule. It is a challenge to the relation back rule. Every time the relation back rule applies, it is because a formal complaint has been filed after the statute of limitations period.
Mm-hmm.
And the commission, as a result of its internal procedures, has bifurcated, has allowed complaining carriers the option of filing an informal complaint because it encourages mediation and perhaps settlement before having the parties undertake the expensive process of filing a formal complaint and a formal response. And that's purely a function of the commission's administrative discretion to adopt procedural rules.
Is there anything that says that if you file that informal complaint, the statute of limitations will no longer apply to any formal complaint you might subsequently file?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question.
Your argument seems to be that if you have filed the informal complaint, the statute of limitations no longer applies to the formal complaint later to be filed. How would I have found that out before this litigation?
The rule itself, 1.718, which is the rule, the relation back rule that's at issue. The last line, that's section.
Where is that in the JA or in your
brief? I think it's in the petitioner's, the end of petitioner's brief.
Blue brief, Roman 13.
Okay, thank you.
It talks about what happens when you miss the relation back deadline, the six-month deadline for filing a formal complaint. I'll wait to get there, Judge Santel.
Go ahead.
All right. If no formal complaint is filed within the six-month period, the complainant will be deemed to have abandoned the unsatisfied informal complaint. Mm-hmm. The language of the rule is not about missing the statutory limitations. It's about failure to prosecute by not filing a formal complaint. And so that, I think that gives adequate notice that once an informal complaint is filed, the statute of limitations has been met. And everything else that happens after that is purely a function of how the commission has structured its adjudicatory processes. It did not have to bifurcate, I shouldn't say bifurcate, but have an informal complaint process, a voluntary informal complaint process. But once again, it does that because it encourages mediation and settlement before the more expensive formal processes go forward.
That's all well and good. It still doesn't get me to the point where I can see that the informal complaint stops the running of the statute of limitations against the formal complaint.
Well, once again, the informal complaint, these are just terms of art. The commission, the formal complaint doesn't, the requirements that a carrier file a formal complaint, the contents of the formal complaint, are once again purely a function of the commission's rule. The commission could say, call the informal complaint a formal complaint and call the formal complaint something else.
It said they can file this informal complaint, and if it doesn't result in settlement, it goes away. Right?
Well, it says that the claim is considered abandoned.
Yeah. That's another more formal way of saying it goes away.
Well, the reason it goes away is not
the key sentence, isn't it, is earlier in that rule where it says such filing of the formal complaint will be deemed to relate back to the filing date of the informal complaint.
What? That's correct.
Right.
It, without the relation back, then the formal complaint would be considered to start a new proceeding and would have to be examined under statute of limitations.
Without relation back, as counsel said, the damages here are going to be about a third of what they would be with relation back. Is that correct?
Without the waiver, right.
Yeah, without the waiver.
I'm not sure about the actual amounts, but it would be significantly less.
Now, can you explain to me what the standard was that was used to allow the waiver here?
Sure. Let me address 2 points on that.
And remember to refer to the commission's opinion when you do it.
I will be happy to.
For the JA page, so I can find it.
Okay. The first on the issue of whether the commission properly applies the good cause standard rather than the higher the threshold, the Meredith issue. I would like to point out that the commission gave 2 reasons why the Meredith standard did not apply in this case. One is that the complaint did not initiate an adjudicatory proceeding. And second, the commission explained, and this is at paragraph 27 of the damages order, which is at JA 56, that the Meredith standard did not occur to a filing that was made, an errant filing. It only applies to filings that were simply not made, where there was no filing in place. And petitioners have not challenged that reasoning at all. So even if they were to prevail on their argument that the formal complaint initiated a new proceeding, the commission's order would still stand on the second reasoning, which is unchallenged in this case, that the higher standard does not apply, the Meredith standard does not apply to formal complaints that are submitted and served during within the formal complaint is submitted and actually filed as opposed to just an errant filing. So with respect to the actual merits of the good cause standard, well, actually, let me turn back to the first issue in Meredith first, which is whether this filing initiated a adjudicatory proceeding. I simply would reiterate that the commission viewed the purpose of this filing as continuing the informal complaint that was filed.
Except the problem I have with that is that I don't see how an adjudicatory proceeding had been begun before the filing of the formal complaint. I mean, you said
our position is the informal complaint begins a proceeding.
The informal complaint had been filed, and there had never been a formal complaint. There would have been no adjudicatory proceeding.
Well,
I thought I understood you to say that.
Well, that's correct.
Adjudicatory proceeding had been commenced until the filing of the formal complaint, had it?
No, for example, if they filed the formal complaint, but they didn't prosecute the case by not filing a brief or not filing it, the case would still be dismissed or go away.
It would have been commenced.
Well, it was.
Question, it would have been commenced with the filing of the formal complaint.
Well, our position is that there's no question it was commenced with the filing of the informal complaint. And the formal complaint simply continued forward. And as other filings in the case continue the case forward. The briefing continues the case forward, and the discovery process continues the case forward.
It would have taken formal action by the commission to do away with the proceeding had it been begun with a formal complaint and the parties had later committed some default. It doesn't automatically abate. It isn't deemed to have been abandoned.
I'm not sure what
the
rule is.
They take formal action to get rid of it, don't they?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the last.
The commission has to take some formal action to get rid of it once the formal complaint's been filed.
Presumably, we'll just have it dismiss it by an order.
Yeah, dismiss it by order. They don't have to dismiss an informal complaint by order, do they? Or do they?
The informal complaint, I'm not sure what the process is if that doesn't go forward at some point, if there's no other activity. I'm not sure if the commission actually dismisses the informal complaint. With respect to the good cause standard itself, I would simply say that the commission did not simply take into account the harm that would the lack of a waiver would cause APCC and the payphone operators. It took into account the nature of the error, the sort of technical nature of the error, the purposes of the timing rule.
Is there a better explanation than paragraph 23 of that part of their reasoning? Or?
You can also look at paragraphs 30 to 33. I think the commission goes into each of NET's arguments in that case and with respect to the waiver.
Okay. On 22, right?
22 gives the factual basis.
Yeah, I think that earlier on it simply talks about the factual basis. I think the main part of the discussion starts at paragraph 23 and goes on for a number of paragraphs after that. The two other, let me just briefly touch on two other issues. With respect to the interest rate, in the third payphone order, as we pointed out in our brief, the commission adopted an 11.25% standard interest rate for late payments for payphone compensation. The commission has never reversed that that argument. That figure, the fourth and fifth reconsideration order did not deal with late payments. That was essentially a one-time true-up situation to deal with the fact that this court initially reversed our original payphone compensation rules. So there have been these payments made both from long-distance carriers to IXCs, long-distance carriers to payphone operators and vice versa, and everyone had to essentially compensate each other to match the new rules that this court ultimately upheld. And so that was a situation in the fourth and fifth reconsideration order, and that was also the situation in the Comtel case, which they cite in the reply brief. That was a case involving the issue related to the fourth and fifth reconsideration order. With respect to pure late payments, the rule has been since the third payphone order that the 11.25% interest rate should apply.
What's the explanation for that particular rate?
It's based on the rate of return, the cost of capital for local exchange carriers.
When was it computed?
I'm not sure when the cost of capital was computed. The third payphone order itself actually came out give me a second.
Yeah,
I don't have that.
It's a moving target, and it would be relevant, I think, in assessing the reasonableness of this to know when that cost.
If it had been raised, Your Honor, but the only argument, if you look at page 353 of the joint appendix, the only argument they make before the commission is that the fourth and fifth reconsideration order essentially reversed the third payphone order, that by its terms applied to this case. And the commission said, no, it doesn't. There was no argument made before the commission that the rate itself has become unreasonable or is no longer a valid rate. The only other point I would like to make with the interest rate is the commission has never called the 11.25% rate punitive. It has said that the IRS overpayment rate in the fourth and fifth reconsideration order was not punitive, but that does not mean that the commission has ever called this rate punitive.
It sounds awfully high for cost of capital in a utility situation.
Well, that might be an argument someone could make in a petition for rulemaking.
It's not made here, you would say.
That's right. And finally, if there are any questions on this issue whether APCC has the amount of compensation that they retain, I'm happy to address it. I don't think it's a question of remand. There is nothing in this record that shows that there's they don't point out any misrepresentation in the record, and if there is one,
maybe
the commission can deal with that in the first instance.
I saw the smiles at your table when we raised the question before. APCC has litigated for years on the basis that they were not taking anything out of these cases, and now a couple of dissents I wrote saying they didn't have standing on that. But it goes to the Supreme Court; they're still not taking anything. Now they're taking something. What happened? What's the difference here than what it's been all these years?
We've had our issues with payphone compensation in the past as well. Not necessarily that one. I can understand your frustration.
I know I've been a witness to most of them, but what has changed that APCC now is admitting they're taking compensation when years they came in here in this court and told us they weren't?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I can say they did not make that representation in this record, so they're, to my knowledge.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, he has no time left. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quick points. On this question of deference, the FCC found that its rules had provided notice of a possessory interest requirement. We are challenging that finding, and that specific finding is not entitled to any deference. So that's what I mean, it's not a deference case, because the finding of whether or not the FCC was right that there was notice is not entitled to deference. Judge Kavanaugh, you mentioned that call tracking is a switching capability, which it surely is. The FCC defines switching capabilities to include all the features and functions that a switch is capable of providing. Now, one problem we've had with the FCC is the record reflected that NET's customers controlled many more switching capabilities than simply call tracking. And the FCC just put blinders on and refused to acknowledge that evidence, that information, and consistently mischaracterized the record as showing that NET's customers only had this call tracking capability when the record clearly reflected otherwise. Now, I never heard counsel, I think, describe what waiver standard they really did apply here. But I think the overwhelming issue for them was making sure that those payphone owners got paid. With respect to
Back to the nature of the mistake. I mean, they do talk about the nature of the mistake. It was filed on the right date. They consulted the wrong version of the CFR, so they put in $165 instead of $170.
Well,
one
check instead of multiple.
One of the things that the FCC has repeated,
that's
correct.
The way you described it in your opening argument does not fit those facts.
Well, the FCC has repeatedly admonished counsel to not wait to the last second to file, because mistakes happen.
So if you file near the deadline, you're,
Well, it was
I doubt anyone in the room will really appreciate that.
Let me talk about
things are filed near deadlines. That's what deadlines do.
Yes, thank you. That's right. Let me turn very quickly to this, once again, to the prejudgment interest, because I think what counsel said was that an IRS rate does not apply to back payments. But in that Contel case, that was exactly where the IRS rate was applied.
But the only objection you have preserved is that the IRS rate has been used in those other cases you cited, as opposed to anything inherently attacking the reasonableness of the 11.25% rate.
Well,
right.
I don't think that's right. FCC's.
Look somewhere in the JA and find that you made some other objection.
I'll have to go find that, Your Honor.
You may submit something in writing then later on that if you have something.
Thank you very much.
Your time is up. We've talked you past your time, and we'll take a recess.